Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is the Interpreter Foundation Radio Show. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. The Interpreter Foundation encourages study of the gospel and faithfulness to the church by making the latest scholarship available in its journal, publishing books, holding seminars, creating films, and by providing roundtable discussions of the scriptures. The Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The material it publishes and our comments on this show are solely the responsibility of the authors, those on the radio, and the foundation. You can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where you can find all of our materials, including these radio programs, which are posted as podcasts. You can also subscribe to this show on iTunes or through any of the best podcast apps on Apple and Android devices. If you like this show, tell your friends about us. Subscribe to our podcast and write a review on iTunes or at your favorite site for podcast apps. This segment of Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Kimber Academy. Kimber Academy is a K-12 private school that keeps God in the classroom. Kimber Academy is a special place where teachers guide students towards faith and morality with quality, engaging curriculum. At Kimber Academy, every parent's voice is heard. In Utah, Kimber Academy is located in Linden, Utah. There are many other locations throughout the United States. To find out more or schedule a tour, call the director, Jessica Bianco, at 801-382-7158 or go to kimberschool.com. That's kimberschool.com. Good evening, everybody. I'm John Thompson. I'm the host tonight, and I am joined in the studio by Martin Tanner. Hello, Martin.
Hi. Good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out. We also have on the line a guest and someone we're going to speak with today. His name is Lauren. My mind just went blank. Lauren, sorry. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah, Lauren Spinlove.
Perfect. Grab the left dial.
Okay.
There you go. Up just a little more on the volume.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Lauren,
testing 1, 2, 3. Can you hear us, Lauren?
I can. I hope you can hear me well.
Yep, we hear you well now.
Great.
Yep.
Perfect. Thank you. And Lauren is actually calling us from England, so he's staying up quite late there. How are you doing over there?
Yeah, down just a touch.
I'm great. I actually took a nap, so I haven't been up continuously for all that long.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Well, we're excited to have you on here to talk with us about a paper that just got published in the Interpreter Foundation Journal. And I'm grateful for you to make the sacrifice to do so. And this paper, well, actually, let me just quickly provide a little background here. Didn't have my computer open on time, so give me 1 second. Lauren, why don't you actually just tell us a little bit about yourself, and then also I had a question about the nature of the paper, like what was the impetus, I guess, for why you decided to write a paper on Jeremiah?
Great. So, just a little background on me. I don't come from a religious studies background or a ancient Near East background. I actually come from a business orientation. I worked for many, many years in finance and accounting and taught accounting. My wife and I retired several years ago, and I started doing the things I wanted to do, which included going back to school. We went and lived in Jerusalem. I attended Hebrew University there. and got a degree in Jewish studies and learned Hebrew. And so that really piqued my interest in the Hebrew roots of the Book of Mormon. And that's how that journey started. Last fall, I read a really interesting book, and that was the journey for how this journey started on this paper. William Niederwin, who is a professor of biblical studies and Northwest Semitic languages at UCLA, wrote his latest book, and it's called Who Really Wrote the Bible? The Story of the Scribes. It was just published last year, and it's a very technical book, but it was also very interesting because it talked a lot about, you know, Noel Reynolds has written a lot of articles for Interpreter about scribal communities in the ancient Near East.
Yep.
And this book really, really delved into that, discussing the scribal communities, the traditions that were borrowed from the Egyptian scribal communities, and how a lot of the ancient Israelite traditions followed that same thing. And there was just one section, it was maybe 10 pages long, where he got into the Book of Jeremiah and started comparing it with the Septuagint version. And his conclusions from that, of course, was that Jeremiah was not considered a prophet in his own time. And so I started comparing that to Jeremiah's treatment in the Book of Mormon, and that was the impetus for the paper.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, and the title of your paper is just plainly Jeremiah the prophet, but you put the prophet in quotation marks because of what you just said, right? That there's this concept that maybe Jeremiah was not considered a prophet until a little bit later. And I think that I've really enjoyed many of the papers you've written over the past years. You have a good sense, a good close reading of scripture, and you seem to have a affinity for some scholars that that I love too, like Robert Alter, who was one of my professors, and I think that being able to read the scriptures not only for the historical context but also a nice literary approach can be really helpful if you can really, especially if you can combine both of those. So tell me a little bit more about just your love and passion for that. You mentioned having a little bit of time taking a degree in Jewish studies. It sounds, it looks like your bio mentions that are you doing another degree right now in Christian scripture?
I am, actually. I'm just finishing up the degree. I have one more class to take. It's actually, the degree is from a university run by the the Churches of Christ, which they're a restorationist movement. And when I say that, I don't mean that they're part of the LDS or Mormon restorationist movement. They are an organization that believes that they want to get back to the original church organization of the early first century. And so they differ significantly in their theology from perhaps evangelicals or Baptists in the way they understand scripture. Anyway, I've been pursuing my degree through them, and I found it to be very helpful. Studied some Greek. My last class is going to be a Latin class, and I'm looking forward to that. I have never studied Latin, and so this will be a great experience for me. But yeah, just finishing that up, and it's really been helpful for me.
That's awesome. Well, let's kind of walk through your paper a little bit. I have some questions, and as we go through, but I'm really curious to kind of get your take on some of my reflections a little bit. But why don't you kind of just give us a quick rundown of just the early part of your paper as you deal with the textual transmissions of the Book of Jeremiah?
Yeah, well, you know, it's fascinating. One of the things over the last several years that I've come to really appreciate is the Septuagint version of the Bible. I think that the Septuagint, and for those in our audience who aren't familiar or don't know a lot about the Septuagint, basically we're talking about the Greek language version of the Bible as opposed to the Hebrew language version of the Bible. And they differ significantly in many places. And the Book of Jeremiah is one of those places where you find the most dramatic differences in the text. For example, the Hebrew version, which is what we use for our Protestant modern Bibles. And when I say Protestant, I'm trying to differentiate between the Catholic version and the version that we use. For example, many of us in the church use the King James Bible, and that would be a Protestant version as opposed to the Catholic version of the Bible. I personally don't use the King James Bible a lot. I typically use one of the newer translations, like the NASB or the NIV. So there is quite a marked difference. For example, the Hebrew version of the Book of Jeremiah is, well, probably about 20% longer than the Greek version, than the Septuagint version. In the past, it was thought by a lot of scholars that the reason for this difference was that when Jeremiah was translated from Hebrew into Greek, this is prior to the time of Christ, that the translator, the scribe, just cut a bunch of material out of the text. And that goes contrary to the normal way of thinking of translation. Typically speaking, scholars generally consider the shorter version of a text to be more original than the longer version, because scribes are more prone to add material to a text than to subtract material from a text. This holds true very often in ancient texts. And so typically the shorter version would be the favored version, but historically speaking, in the case of the Septuagint, that is not the conclusion that scholars have come to. This began to be doubted a couple of hundred years ago.
Well, I was going to answer real quickly. I think it's interesting that not only is it shorter, but it has a different arrangement of some of the chapters, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
It absolutely does. The first half of the Book of Jeremiah, if you compare the Hebrew and the Greek versions, they flow very well together. The chapters are perfectly in sync from chapter 1 all the way through chapter 25. But after that, they change dramatically. For example, chapter 33 in the Hebrew version, which is what we would have in our Bible, is chapter 40 in the Septuagint. And so they're all mixed up after that.
Yeah.
So a very different transmission history there.
Yeah, and that should be a good clue that it's not just a translator dropping material, because they have to be dropping it and rearranging it. But yeah, so go on. I think there's another idea.
Yeah, so with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls back in the late 1940s, a lot of these ideas began to shift. several fragments of the Book of Jeremiah have been found at Qumran, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And all of these fragments are in Hebrew. And a lot of those fragments that have been found align with our Hebrew version that we use, but some of them align with the Greek version, but they're not written in Greek, they're written in Hebrew. And so that's changed almost all biblical scholars today. Not all, but I would say the vast majority, at least 90%, would say today that they believe that the book of Jeremiah that exists in Greek today was actually translated from a Hebrew version, but a very different version of Jeremiah than what made it into our current Bibles. So that there were two Hebrew versions that existed of the book of Jeremiah going around at the same time, and both were respected as being authentic in some way.
That wouldn't be too different. If I can jump in, that wouldn't be too different from the Synoptic Gospels and people thinking, yeah, those all tell the story of Jesus and we can respect them. And there is some overlap, of course, with the book of Mark and the other two, but there are some real differences. I don't know if that's a sound enough parallel for but they're all well respected.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are, even though we call them the Synoptic Gospels because they tend to have the same type of appearance, you're right. There are significant differences between those three books. And so we have a very similar thing going on with Jeremiah in both Hebrew and Greek. And almost all scholars have come to the conclusion that the Greek version of Jeremiah was translated from Hebrew, but from a very different version of the Hebrew that made it into our Bibles. And that version of the Hebrew was more ancient than the version that we use in what we call the Masoretic text today. So there's a precedence given to the book of Jeremiah in the Septuagint now that is believed to be older than the tradition that we use. So it really elevates at least the book of Jeremiah in the Septuagint above that, I would say, of the Masoretic version that we use, the translation of the Masoretic text.
What's the earliest Masoretic text that's available? Last time I looked into that, it was something like 950 AD, which is not particularly early.
You're right. So the oldest complete Masoretic text that we have is only just over 1,000 years old, and I mean just about 1,000 years old. And of course, with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and a lot of those aligning with the Masoretic text, for example, the Great Isaiah Scroll is a very close alignment with the Masoretic text. So you could say that is perhaps the oldest text for Isaiah that we have. There are differences, of course. The Dead Sea Scrolls don't have any of the vowel points that the Masoretes inserted into the text. And there are some changes in the text that aren't terribly significant. Sometimes they are. But generally speaking, that Dead Sea Scroll, the Great Isaiah Scroll from Qumran, aligns very well with our current Masoretic text that we use. You can't say the same for Jeremiah, though, because only fragments have been found. We don't have a complete text at Qumran. So when it comes to the book of Jeremiah, we really are looking at that 1,000-year-old source that we have that is used for our translation.
How much of Jeremiah do we have in Qumran fragments, approximately?
Very little. That's a really great question. there were only two significant fragments found that aligned with the Qumran, that aligned with the Septuagint. They were able to look at those and see that the wording and the organization aligned with that, with the Septuagint. I think there are only something like four more fragments in addition to those two. And those, on the other hand, aligned with the Masoretic text. So very few. It's, I don't know why, probably because of the late date of Jeremiah, but I'm not sure why we have much less. We don't have a surviving scroll like the great Isaiah scroll, which is the entire book of Isaiah almost completely intact that survived at Qumran. We do not have that for Jeremiah at all.
Well, maybe they were just destroyed. They just didn't last. You know, we have little parts of all of the Old Testament except Esther, but when you look at that compared with the full 900, there are about 900 Dead Sea Scrolls books, and so, you know, a third are secular, a third are extra biblical, and a third are biblical, but then you've got 35,000 or so fragments that are unidentifiable, and maybe among those you had some what were originally pristine copies of Jeremiah. I mean, we just don't know. So much we found it at the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but so much we just don't know what was originally there.
I'm going to jump in
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in and try to real quickly just summarize so far then what we've talked about, that we have basically an idea that back in Jeremiah's day, there may have been two Hebrew traditions or two texts that were created. An earlier text in early part of Jeremiah's ministry, perhaps, and then a later text that either developed from that earlier text or even in Jeremiah's day or later may have developed from that earlier text. But these two texts separate into different geographic locations, in the world and have their own history. And the earlier text ends up influencing or being translated into the Septuagint, the Greek version that we know of. And the later of the two Hebrew texts ends up influencing the Masoretic tradition. And so that might explain why we have these differences between the Masoretic and the Septuagint version. And then, as you mentioned, the Dead Sea Scrolls come along and kind of help us see a little bit more clearly, even though we don't have a lot of material from Jeremiah, the little material we do have can help us see and help us understand that maybe the Septuagint version of Jeremiah is the earlier text. Is that a good summary?
I think so. You did a great job.
All right. So why is this important, right? What's the relevance of this? And I think what's really interesting about your paper is that you recognize that how Jeremiah is being described in the earlier text versus the later text changes a little bit. And that also might be reflected in the Book of Mormon. And so that's why it's significant or important for us and why you wrote the paper, I believe. So you want to talk to us about the title prophet?
Yeah, boy, that word is loaded with all sorts of meaning. And, especially in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that comes with all sorts of interpretation. If you were to talk to people of different faiths around the world, you'd get all sorts of different definitions of what a prophet is. But I think if you were to ask a lot of members of the LDS Church what the word prophet meant, they would say, well, it's somebody who receives revelation from God and communicates that to us as members of the church. And while that wouldn't be a wrong response, it's not what the plain meaning of the word prophet is. In fact, the church on its website, when if you look up, I think the word prophet in the Bible dictionary, it says that the primary job of a prophet is to proclaim or expound about divine matters. It's not really to reveal things that God has shared with them. And so that falls more under the role of a seer rather than a prophet. So
yeah, so we're getting technical here because obviously we sustain our church leaders as prophets, seers, and revelators, and so we've kind of conflated all of those terminology together. But you're trying to say that there's actually a real distinct difference between prophet and seer.
Especially during Jeremiah's time.
Yeah, especially during Jeremiah's time. There was a lot of confusion about who was speaking for the Lord. And, you know, it seems like you had the majority of individuals that claimed to fill the role of prophet that weren't actually prophesying for the Lord. Because a lot of what they said just didn't happen. And as it turns out, what Jeremiah said did happen. But of course, we know that from hindsight. And so Jeremiah in the Septuagint, when Jeremiah talks about these other prophets, the word that is typically used is pseudo-prophet, which would be, of course, false prophet. And that's what he refers to the other prophets as pseudo-prophets. So the definition of the word, if you look up in the Bible dictionary of the church and you look up the word prophet, it says in certain cases, prophets predicted future events, such as the very important prophecies announcing the coming of the Messiah's kingdom. But as a rule, a prophet was a foreteller rather than a foreteller. And so somebody who just teaches the truth is considered a prophet in that sense, whereas somebody who tells about the future, that really does fall more under the role of a seer or revelator.
Yeah, that was actually one of my questions. Like, I can see the difference between prophet and seer, and I think even the Book of Mormon kind of talks about how a seer can reveal hidden things, right? Things that have not been known yet. And so that's kind of how we typically think of a prophet. But that's, like you said, like it's more like a role of a seer to bring forth things that God has kept hidden and now he's trying to reveal. But what is the difference between a revelator and a seer? I don't know if there's any good distinction that you can think of there.
Well, the word seer comes from two different words in Hebrew. One is Roe, the other is Jose. And both of those have roots in the verb to see. And so they literally mean somebody who sees. So in that sense, a seer would receive a vision where they see something, and then they relate that vision to the people. A revelator could receive future type information from any type of source. In that case, a revelator could hear a voice from heaven speaking to him or her and then reveal that to the people. It doesn't necessarily have to come through visual means, but because those two other words are both rooted in verbs that mean to see. Mm-hmm. That seems to indicate that there is some type of visionary process going on.
Yeah, nice. Okay, so a prophet then is someone who speaks authoritatively, right, on behalf of someone else. And go ahead.
I'm just going to say, yeah. So if you look at both the Book of Mormon, well, in fact, specifically at the Book of Mormon, Nephi names very few prophets as prophets. But one of those that he names as a prophet is the one who would baptize Jesus. And that, of course, would be John the Baptist. And so you think about it and you go, what did John do that made him a prophet? Mm-hmm. Well, do we find any great visions or revelations from John anywhere in the New Testament? Does he prophesy to us about anything that's going to happen in the future? Well, not really. At least we don't have that. What we do have from John is that he's preaching that the Messiah has come, is already there, and that we are to prepare the way for the Messiah. And that was the role of a prophet, was to just get out there and proclaim the truth to the people. And in that sense, John the Baptist fulfills the role of a prophet, not necessarily of a seer or even a revelator, but definitely the role of a prophet. And that's, of course, why Nephi would refer to him as a prophet.
Yeah, and so I think that's a really important distinction. Again, someone who's out there, like you said, declaring the word, and I'm assuming because Jeremiah spends a lot of time, especially like in chapter 23, talking about false prophets, as you mentioned earlier, and that these prophets were not sent, right? They were not somebody that God had authorized to go out there and make proclamations. And so there seems to be an authorization kind of component. And we oftentimes talk about, Jeremiah talks about the true prophets are the ones who have stood in the sowed, right? The secret council of heaven. And we read about Isaiah, for example, standing in the temple of God and God cleanses him and then authorizes him, right? He commissions him to go out and speak. And so this idea of being commissioned by God or authorized, I think, is a really important concept of prophethood. But like you said, it doesn't mean that they're actually going out prophesying of the future or even necessarily revealing new things. That's kind of more like the role of a seer and revelator, but more about just being God's mouthpiece, right? His emissary.
Right. And there is the whole issue of authorization, and that is very important. As I mentioned earlier, the verb behind the word prophet is nava in Hebrew. And I don't want to get too technical here, but there is a form of that verb, which you could say is lehit nave, which means to make oneself a prophet. And Jeremiah was accused of doing that by one of these other false prophets. They said that Jeremiah had made himself a prophet. Mm. And of course, so that's the accusation against Jeremiah, that he is not a real authorized prophet to speak for God, but he has made himself a prophet.
Yeah.
Of course, he disputes that and claims that the other prophets are the false prophets, not him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really, for the lay people, it's pretty a big conundrum, right? Which one is the authorized one? And how do you know? And of course, Jesus kind of talks about that and just says by their fruits, right? There might be a little bit something there. But
And of course, the issue is that none of this has happened. It's just starting to happen. And Jeremiah, what he has been saying all along is starting to come true, but it's hard to see if it's really going to last. You know, where he, of course, says that you're going to be in captivity for 70 years. So just settle down, have children, build houses in captivity, and then the Lord will free you eventually in 70 years. And the false prophets are saying, oh, no, we're only going to be here for a short time. Then the Lord's going to restore us back to the land. And of course, how do you know which one's going to actually come true? Well, you know, as the years pass, it becomes obvious that Jeremiah was the one speaking for the Lord. But that wasn't so clear at the time. That was not so easy to see.
Yeah.
Another quick question. Could one of the other reasons that Jeremiah may not have been considered a genuine prophet be due to his very, very young age? He says right up front in the book of Jeremiah that he's a child, essentially. I mean, you know, the the underlying word there would imply that he might even not be a teenager yet. I mean, he's just a kid, and he's worried about the calling. So if he was that young, maybe he didn't have as much standing as someone who was older might have had.
Yeah, you know, there could be some validity to that. There was also the issue that Jeremiah was commanded not to get married.
Yes.
And so he is single, without a family. Jeremiah comes from a priestly family. His father and grandfather all the way back were priests. But I think the major reason that Jeremiah was rejected by the other priests is that he's not a Jerusalemite temple priest. He comes from an outside community, from a place called Anathoth, which was not part of he was not a Zadokite priest, and as such was not entitled to serve at the temple. He was a Levitical priest, which the Jerusalemite temple priests would have looked down on him, possibly, as a lesser type priest than themselves. And I think that probably was what fueled a lot of the rejection of Jeremiah, plus the fact that he's prophesying against them. And, you know, their attitude is, hey, you know, we can display our lineage, our priestly lineage, and it goes back to, you know, this Zadokite priesthood, which is superior to the priesthood that you have. And so who are you to criticize us? You're this guy who starts off young. You're not married. You're not one of us. You're an outsider. And I think that was a really big issue.
Yeah, I'm curious. So if he, you know, so he comes and he has a priestly pedigree, but like you said, it's a marginal priestly pedigree as opposed to the Jerusalemite priests. But he's acting like a prophet, which they're rejecting, right? They're saying he's making himself one. Do you know what in the communities of that time period, what made one a prophet in the eyes of the people, apart from, like we talked about earlier, the fact that the words that they gave of God might be fulfilled in time? Is there anything else more technical, more concrete that would say, oh yeah, you check all the boxes for what makes a prophet?
You know, that is such a good question, and it's something that I've pondered a lot in reading all this, doing the research, and writing the paper. I was thinking, boy, where would I stand when it came to Jeremiah? I mean, if I were a resident of Jerusalem, and this guy shows up from kind of a no-place city, and yeah, he's a priest and all that, but nobody really knows him, and he just shows up and starts saying, hey, all of you prophets and you Jerusalemite priests, you're leading this people astray, and God's going to lead them into captivity because of your wickedness. Would I have listened to somebody like this? I mean, it's not like they held a general conference and Jeremiah was sustained by people raising their hands saying, yeah, we accept you as a prophet. I mean, really, you've just kind of got Jeremiah's word for it.
Yeah.
And so
there's always that.
How do you know?
Yeah, just that beautiful thing that we talk about, the Spirit, right? Kind of helpful.
Well, Jesus had the same problem, you know. Can anything good come from Bethlehem, right? You know? And he was definitely the real McCoy. So Jeremiah's in good company.
Yeah. And you're right. You know, you've got Jesus who comes along, and why should we believe this guy? You know, and you put yourself in the position of the priest. Who's this guy? I mean, he's not even a priest.
He's
not from any Levitical tribe or anything. And who is he to tell us how we're supposed to live and how we're supposed to do things? We know that we're doing it correctly. Why is he trying to correct us? And so Jeremiah's in a similar type position. And so I wonder, how would I have responded to Jeremiah's preaching?
Well, thank you. So, okay, so moving on, you have this, so we have Jeremiah who comes in, and again, the people are questioning his authenticity as a prophet, a true prophet of God. And of course, Jeremiah is telling the priests and prophets of Jerusalem that they are the ones who are false and leading people astray. And he does again point out that if they had stood in my counsel, right, if they had stood in the Sod, then you could have agreed that they were true prophets, but I have not sent these. So the idea of Jeremiah becoming a prophet or accepted as a prophet, especially in sacred literature, seems to have developed a little bit. And this is the point that people are making in the biblical scholarly world, and then the point you want to make as it pertains to the Book of Mormon. So what seems to have happened? Like, why does he become associated with prophets?
Well, and that depends on who you talk to.
Yeah.
Schniedewin offers the idea that when the people are restored to the land and the Persians conquer eventually, the Babylonians, they take over, and the whole land now is under control of the Persians, and those who are in captivity are allowed to return to Jerusalem to reestablish the temple. And of course, this tribal community gathers together. Schniedewin's idea seems to be that they did not want Jeremiah associated with them. Still, they view him as an outsider, and they don't even want to label him as a priest. And so they label him a prophet, perhaps in low regard still of what a prophet is, wanting maybe to distance themselves. I'm not sure I agree with that view. Perhaps they did finally come to realize that, hey, Jeremiah was right after all. Maybe he actually was a prophet of God. I think that's possibly the more likely scenario.
You would think, because if you look at if you look at everything that he wrote, it came to pass very and his predictions were not vague. This was a guy who had very concrete predictions. So sorry, I jumped
right
in the middle of your thought.
No worries. That's perfectly fine. So I tend to follow that idea that it finally, they just couldn't deny it anymore. And so then they start labeling him the prophet. But this is only done really in the Masoretic text, in the Hebrew text that we have now. The Greek, only four times does it ever refer to Jeremiah as the prophet, where the Hebrew version of our text refers to him as the prophet more than two dozen times. And the key point is we have this bifurcation, this separation between the two texts in chapter 25. The Greek version never refers to him as a prophet in those first 25 chapters, where the Hebrew version does. So clearly the scribes went back and added a lot of things in the Hebrew version that we have. One of the key places where the later scribes added a lot to the Hebrew version, I had mentioned it earlier, but it's in the Jeremiah chapter 33 in the Masoretic text, which is Jeremiah 40 in the Greek version. And in that, half of the chapter that exists in our Hebrew version of Jeremiah just doesn't exist at all in the Greek version of Jeremiah. It's completely missing. And so most scholars, again, believe that that second half of chapter 33 was added by later scribes. And, you know, we want to have this idea that the scribes in antiquity never touched the text, that they just left them intact the way that they were given to them. But we know that that's not the case. There was a lot of messing around with the text. Things were added, things were taken out, a lot of wording changes. And so definitely the scribes in antiquity felt a lot of ease adding material to the text. We find that in the New Testament too.
Yeah, and I think it's
where
Go ahead. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's interesting, like you said, that oftentimes they'll take, if they do have a verse that's the same in both the Greek and in the Hebrew renderings later, that the Hebrew will simply add the title prophet to Jeremiah's name, right? And it kind of helps us see that,
yes,
that they're just trying to clarify that this is how they're viewing him now. And like you said, it may be because his teachings have come to pass, and so it's kind of hard to deny it at this point.
So we have
just a few minutes left, so we want to get to the big reveal, okay?
Yeah.
Which, of course, is how does this relate to the Book of Mormon?
So that's a great question. And Nephi, and we're talking about Lehi's Nephi here, Nephi 1, we could call him. Nephi mentions Jeremiah twice, and the interesting thing is that he never refers to Jeremiah as a prophet. And so, which I find fascinating, he seems to exclude Jeremiah from the prophets, because he says that the people have rejected the prophecies of all the holy prophets. And then he says, and Jeremiah have they thrown into prison. That is one of the instances where he mentions him. And so, you know, you think, well, why didn't he just say, and the prophet Jeremiah they've thrown into prison, to top it off? You know, you look at it, Lehi was definitely a prophet in the land of Jerusalem prior to their departure. And yet Lehi also is never referred to as a prophet in the Book of Mormon. And yet he clearly fulfills the role of prophet, but he also clearly was not accepted as a prophet. The people tried to kill him, and that's why Lehi and his family had to leave, because his life was under threat.
It's a really interesting point, and I think that the idea that that the text seems to separate Jeremiah out from the prophets a little bit, as you highlight a couple of times, so 1 Nephi chapter 5 is one of them, where it mentions even down to the commencement of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, and also the prophecies of the holy prophets from the beginning. So you're talking about the brass plates, right, that contained the prophecies of the holy prophets from the beginning, even down to the commencement of the reign of Zedekiah, and also many prophecies which have been spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah. And so you have this distinction of Jeremiah from the prophets as a body. I was curious about the use of the word the prophecies of Jeremiah. So what is a prophecy? You know, is that different than being a prophet? If the fact that he...
Well...
Yeah, go ahead.
And that's really interesting, because the water gets a little bit muddied here.
Yeah.
In English, the word prophecy typically is talking about a forthcoming event. And so in that case, he's almost indicating that Jeremiah is acting as a revealer,
right,
rather than as a prophet. Hmm. And so, and of course, Lehi did the same thing. And I think Nephi feels a lot of sympathy and affinity with Jeremiah, because Nephi's own father, Lehi, went through the same thing as Jeremiah. We don't have any record of Lehi being cast into prison the way Jeremiah was. But there was the same type of people rejecting him and people rejecting the message that he was giving to them, to the point that they wanted to kill him. So I think we see a lot of Nephi being able to relate very strongly with Jeremiah and his situation, like, hey, you know, my father was a prophet. People said, no, you're not. We're going to kill you. And they did the same thing with Jeremiah. They rejected him, threw him into prison, called him a false prophet, somebody who makes himself a prophet. And so I think Nephi really saw that the real prophets were rejected and the pseudo prophets were the ones who were embraced. And So that's the connection with the Book of Mormon. We don't find Jeremiah being named a prophet in the Book of Mormon until we get much later, about 500 years later, in fact, when we get Nephi 2, who finally refers to Jeremiah as a prophet.
I really liked your close reading of the earlier text about Nephi saying that what the brass plates contained were prophecies spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah, as opposed to the writings of Jeremiah, that we don't maybe have like a Jeremiah tradition of written teachings that then get copied into the brass plates, but the brass plates keepers were just writing down what they had heard, or you know, that was again spoken by his mouth. I thought that was a pretty interesting reading.
Well, and interestingly on that, Schneiderwin brings up in his book, and Noel Reynolds talks about this too, that it really was, to think of authorship in the ancient world the way we think of authorship today is really anachronistic. There were no authors of books. It was really scribal communities that passed on religious traditions and passed on books. And it was these scribal groups that put together all of these writings. And of course, that's why we have two different organizations of the Book of Jeremiah in the Septuagint and in the Hebrew version, where the chapters are even in different order from each other.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it really begs the question for me, like, why was the brass plate scribes recording Jeremiah's words? They obviously thought there was something to it. And this is previous to them leaving, for the Babylonian destruction. So there's some people, obviously, who see Jeremiah's words as being something to record. And I think, you know, that just tells us that not everybody in Jerusalem hated him. Right? There were some. And the fact that he maybe, you know, came from outside of Jerusalem, and the brass plates are a tradition that we believe was not a Jerusalem tradition. It was probably a northern tribe record, you know, that maybe that they were like recording Jeremiah because he was going after the establishment in Jerusalem. I don't know. So.
Yeah. And of course, we can only speculate about that, but that is a really interesting thing to wonder about. And I have also wondered about that very thing. You know, who is it that's actually recording these words, and what words are they actually recording?
Yeah.
Did somebody just hear Jeremiah speaking, and then he came in and wrote some things, or what is this individual even working with? The interesting thing is that nobody in the Book of Mormon ever cites these words of Jeremiah. We don't know what was on the brass plates.
Yeah, good point. Hey, well, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining with us all the way from across the pond there. And and the article is Jeremiah the Prophet. The author, Lauren Spinlove, is who we've been talking with. Lauren, thank you so much for your time and for your good work.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And get some sleep now. Take care.
I will. It's 3:00 in the morning.
Okay. Bye-bye.